From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not as if the lives of the Roosevelts, Theodore, Franklin, Eleanor, hadn't been explored. So what would make filmmaker Ken Burns want to spend 7 years crafting one of his epic documentaries about them? Well, people said the same thing about the Civil War, that it had been covered. But as Burns' film on the war revealed, millions of Americans still tuned in to see the stories. Ken Burns' 7-part series on the Roosevelts began last night on PBS, and he's counting on viewers to still be drawn to the stories. Today in the program, Ken Burns is joining us to talk about how he weaves together the stories of these three remarkable people and whether he thinks this style of filmmaking, a style he created, still works today. Ken Burns, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There has been a lot written about the Roosevelts, Theodore, Franklin, Eleanor. But the filmmaker Ken Burns says he was surprised no one had woven those three stories together, which is how he describes his latest film, as this interbraided family story, like a Russian novel, he says. The epic documentary on the Roosevelts got underway last night on PBS stations around the country. It's 7 episodes, 2 hours each, which seems pretty daunting in pretty much every way, creating it, consuming it. In fact, it's one of the things we talked about with Ken Burns when we spoke late last week, whether Americans are still up for a series that takes its time.
We live in a media culture now that's sort of drowning in information and very little understanding. And our default position is to move to some conventional wisdom about all and everything in history, and particularly these Roosevelts. And so I assume they've been segregated because Franklin's a Democrat and T.R. is a Republican, right. But they are more similar than they are different. And it was into that complicated story of deeply talented but also deeply flawed and deeply wounded people who had to somehow translate their wounds into some sort of positive force that makes it just one of the best, most compelling dramas I've ever come across.
I wonder how much you have wondered whether Americans, how much, if they have changed since the first of those epic series, the Civil War. This was 1990. Do Americans, just in general, have the same kind of, well, I'll put it this way, attention span that they might have had in 1990?
You know, the question of attention span is a really important one, but it's not deep. It's superficial because all human beings, whether they're Americans or from Ghana, understand deep down somewhere that all real meaning accrues in duration, that the work you're proudest of, the relationships you care the most about, have benefited from your sustained attention. I've got a 9-year-old daughter who's, you know, addicted to phone and iPad, and set them all down in April and read 7 Harry Potter books, each one of which takes longer to watch than my longest series. So yes, we are fragmented. Yes, you know, I remember when Civil War came out in 1990. That's nearly a quarter of a century ago. Yeah. All the critics were saying nobody will watch it. Everybody's got the attention span that's based on MTV and a music video, and it's quick cutting, and look at you, you're neither. And it's the highest rated program in American public television history. And then they said the same thing 17 years later when there were no longer 15 channels, but now 515 channels, yeah, about the war and our drama, our documentary series on the history of the World War II. And it got almost the same ratings. And so I think what happens is there is an appetite, certainly our day-to-day stuff is occupied. Our head is buried in our devices. We bump into other people. You know, we forget to look up and meet someone's eye in the elevator. Yes, we're distracted by all of this stuff. But at the end of the day, the things that are going to matter are the things that accrue in duration. And that will mean digesting either, you know, for 2 hours a gulp every night for 7 straight nights as the Roosevelts go out, or perhaps taking advantage of the free streaming that happens on Monday morning, the 15th, to do it in a binge fashion. Mm-hmm. But I think that tendency towards binging that we do now is a way to clear out that clutter, to push away all that other stuff and say, I wish to be my own person with this one thing for a while.
Yeah.
And so I'm, of course, as a parent and as a citizen, worried about all of those things. But I think, you know, human nature remains the same, and we will still get ultimate satisfactions out of the deeper dives.
You know, it occurred to me watching it, it's like a novel. The story
yes.
has to kind of play out, and you have to settle in. And I wondered if you thought about that as you're constructing each of these pieces, that you there's a bit of a prologue here at the beginning. We're drawn in,
yes.
but then we span out and we take our time. And hopefully, I'm guessing you're thinking as they relate to these stories, they'll settle in.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You're very wise. That's exactly the way it is. And a novel, you know, is similar, I suppose, in structures. We've got many, many other competing things. And, of course, we shed many things, interior things, that a novel can count on. You can always stop and go back and reread a paragraph or the chapter as you catch up. But, yes, you want to have an overture, a prologue, an invitation to this thing that has some sense of shooting something across the bow of the arc of this narrative. Mm-hmm. And then your first narrative has to have a pace to it that brings people along. So you will find in retrospect that the first episode, which encompasses essentially the entire 19th century, from 1858 when Theodore Roosevelt was born to his ascension to president in 1901 through the assassination of William McKinley, is got many, many more constituent parts than any other episode. They're coming at you. You're beginning to set the stage. You're setting the scene. You're introducing lots of different characters, both the principal three characters and also many subsidiary characters, as well as understanding the kind of America that we're in that, strangely enough, has echoes with what you're thinking you might be dealing about several decades from now when you get around to, say, Franklin Roosevelt's presidency or even Eleanor Roosevelt's widowhood when she's dealing in a Cold War world with a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You're hearing Theodore Roosevelt impatient about the courts and how they seem to be lagging behind popular sentiment. And that's developed in Episode 2. And in Episode 3, William Howard Taft is excoriating him for his treading so lightly with the Constitution and particularly with regard to the independence of the judiciary. Mm-hmm. And maybe you get it on the first viewing, maybe you don't. But of course, Franklin Roosevelt is famous in our fifth episode for having tried to pack the Supreme Court. It was just an initial suggestion. It didn't go anywhere. But it's one of those things that our conventional wisdom always seizes upon and goes, see, aha, he was this dictator. The Constitution actually never says there have to be 9 justices. And he was hoping, because the Supreme Court had seemed to move conservatively and had declared unconstitutional some really important set things to him of his New Deal program, that he was responding just as his distant fifth cousin Theodore was responding to right. with frustration when you had a kind of activist, almost ADD president that Theodore was, and that you had this huge crisis, the Great Depression, that Franklin Roosevelt was trying so many different ways to figure out how to contain. And then, of course, looming ahead, as he knew perhaps better than anyone else, including Theodore, who predicted it, was the Second World War.
Yeah. You have a unique process that I wanted to ask you about. And believe me, I'm going to ask you questions about Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt. But I'm interested in this process.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad you are. That's wonderful.
Good, good. Most documentary filmmakers, certainly a lot of them, have this kind of set process. There's the research period, and then there's this writing period, and then that gets set, and then there's the editing period, that gets set. But you've talked about how much more fluid your process is than that, and here's sort of how you've put it. You've said, we want the subject to talk to us. Explain that, if you would.
Well, I think when you have a set research and a set writing period, you tend to then produce a document at the end of that, a script, which is kind of written in stone as if it's coming down from Mount Sinai, and it informs the shooting and the editing, and boom, done.
Yeah.
But you want to be corrigible on these big, big projects. You want to learn stuff as you go along. I'm not telling you what I already know about the Roosevelts. The last time I checked, that's homework. I want to share with you a process of discovery, and that's much more important. So we never stop researching, and our writing is constantly changing. And one of the ways in which it's changing, I mean, there are historical advisors. We learn new things. We discover photographs. We find a treasure trove of footage, whatever it might be. But one of it is that the second you put one shot and then another shot together, a third thing happens. And all of a sudden, and this is a film filled with maybe 3,000, 4,000 shots, right, it starts talking to you. I like that improbable calculus that 1 and 1 equals 3. That's what I'm talking about. And it's that 3 thing that is shot 1 and shot 2, or voice 1 and voice 2, or music 1 and music 2, or whatever element it is that put together in combination suggests something else. We're obligated to listen to that. Mm-hmm. And as we watch the film talk back to us, we learn and understand its rhythms and understand what it kind of needs. And a great deal of editing is, of course, imposing things on this raw material. But it's not equally, but a large portion is still listening to that material. So you realize that decisions are made on so many levels. The music, which is one of the quickest ways, it's like mainlining emotion. You know, if Tolstoy is right and an art is the transfer of emotion from one person to another, there's no quicker vehicle than music, yes, the heroine of arts. If you're adding sound effects to that and talking heads, and you're adding footage and live cinematography. So now you're beginning to juggle with a whole number of things that then require the application of technique, which if done authentically, honorably and authentically, becomes style. Yeah. And when we recognize style in a painter or in a musician, what we're recognizing is that person's authentic response to all of those conversations that are going on in the editing room, among your collaborators, in your own head, in your heart, mainly, because you know I'm not interested in excavating some dry date facts and events of the past where there'll be a quiz next Tuesday. I mean, I'm just not involved with that. I'm interested in a kind of emotional archaeology that might sort of realize that the ghosts and echoes of this almost inexpressibly wise past of ours is speaking, and we can let them talk. Theodore Roosevelt has a lot to say, yeah, to us right now. Eleanor Roosevelt is burning to tell you what you should be doing better. And Franklin has ideas of how to fix things.
You made a reference to style there, and I think you're one of those unique, truly unique filmmakers who has created a style, an iconic style. It's your own. And it occurred to me, I was thinking about that maybe aside from, you know, the width of a suit lapel here or there or a different hairstyle, it occurred to me also, by the way, that George Will never seems to go gray, but we can put that aside for a minute.
He's the eternal boy. I get accused about that, and I think yes, it's great to have George in my films. He's been in 4 films of mine, and he's an important agent
in these films. But it's hard to fix your films in a particular time, and I think that's terrific.
Oh, yes, it is. And that speaks to something that's hugely important, which is Ecclesiastes said, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. This is how I understand that. Human nature always remains the same. And so while historians like to talk about cycles of history, I don't believe there are cycles of history. There's the famous phrase attributed to George Santayana that we are condemned to repeat what we don't remember. It's a beautiful phrase. I wish it was true. I don't think it's true. I think human nature superimposes itself on the random chaos of events, and we see patterns. And so we study the past not because it's some sort of past time. it's actually the greatest guide to the present and to the future. Because, you know, I'll give you an example. When the 08 meltdown happened, people come to me and say, you know, you're a historian. This is as bad as the Depression. And I go, sorry. In most American cities, the animals in the zoo were shot and the meat distributed to the poor. When that happens, we'll be in a depression. Does that make you feel better? Yes, yes, yes. And so what I think, I mean, this is a very simplistic way of describing something that's very, very complex, which is having an understanding of your past actually gives you access to how people, successful and not, good and not, have negotiated the complicated thing, the passage we call life. And so we are obligated to study our history, it seems to me, because A, none of us are getting out of this thing, life, alive. And while none of us are sitting in a fetal position because of that awareness, we don't spend enough time understanding how much the past can arm us for the present. That you know, Harry Truman said it really well. He said, the only thing that's really new is the history you don't know. And I mean, that is the exact opposite of what the momentum and force of that media culture with its small attention span would perceive.
It's Ken Burns. His documentary, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, began last night on PBS stations around the country. It runs through Saturday. You can see it here in Utah on KUED Channel 7, beginning at 7 p.m. We should also mention you can stream the episodes after they air. Last night's episode is now available online. You can go to our website for a link, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns. We spoke with him late last week. His film, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, has 7 parts to it. Episode 1 was last night. The rest are running throughout the week. We'll give you more details about that a little later in the program. Let's talk about Teddy Roosevelt. There's a terrific line from the film, fueled by cup after cup of coffee served to him in a special mug that his eldest son said was as big as a bathtub, Theodore Roosevelt raced through his day. Do you have a sense now, having done this film, of what this man was like? He has a dozen eggs for breakfast at times. I mean, it must have been hard to keep up.
Most definitely. And I think I do have a sense of him. And it's a complicated portrait. You know, we like to use him as the model, the San Juan Hill, the Rough Rider, this great thing. And people come up to me on the street, can't wait to see the Roosevelts. Teddy Roosevelt is my hero. You know, well, first thing of all, he didn't like to be called Teddy. He was TR or he was Theodore or Mr. Roosevelt or more to his liking, Mr. President.
Right.
And but this is a man who was a sickly, asthmatic child. He'd overheard a doctor tell his parents that he wasn't expected to survive childhood. He tried to remake his body and did, for the most part, never escaped asthma. He had the worst tragedy you could imagine. He lost his mother and his wife on the same day in the same house, February 14th. And this was a man in a branch of the family that was susceptible to depression, to mental illness, and to alcoholism. And it's really important to understand Theodore Roosevelt as a kind of manic depressive. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not making a diagnosis. Someone who felt compelled to outrun his demons all the time, because when he didn't, this darkness would settle in on him and really torment him. And he spent his whole life at full tilt, full speed. Now, just stop for a second. If you can imagine the oldest photograph you can think of Theodore Roosevelt, he looks about 85 years old. I'm 61 and people remark on my boyish looks, but Theodore Roosevelt died when he was 60, a spent and exhausted vessel. Franklin Roosevelt, just as an aside, looks like he's 95 or 100, almost cadaverous when he dies. He was 63. This is an amazing story of the Roosevelts. Both Eleanor and her favorite uncle and his favorite niece, her, both spent their whole lives in perpetual motion, terrified of what would happen if they slowed down. Franklin, who could not walk, could not outrun his demons, and so actually had to transform things in a much more sane way. And he came from a saner branch of the family, yeah. less susceptible to alcoholism and madness, it seems. The fact that they're alive and became who they became, all three of them, is kind of testament to the resilience of the human spirit.
There's a terrific visual metaphor that you use in the film to sort of convey this sense of, like, they were sharks. You know, they had to keep moving. Certainly Eleanor yes. and Theodore Roosevelt. But it's Theodore Roosevelt's clenched fist.
He seemed infatuated with everything, so long as it provided him with the opportunity to excel. He was in almost perpetual motion, riding, swimming, shooting, competing in the long jump and 100-yard dash against his brother and his cousins. He rarely won, but he always tried. And in between, he devoured books and liked to recite poetry by the hour to his New York neighbor and sometimes sweetheart, Edith Caro. His energy seems so superabundant, his father wrote, that I feel it may get the better of him in one way or another.
I think if he were a little boy today, he might be given Ritalin and grow up to be a salesman of some sort, and we would never have heard from him again. Look at photographs of him whenever he's seated, if he has a hand on a desk or a hand on his knee. It's always in a fist. There's all that coiled energy. It's not anger, it's just energy coiled, waiting to be let loose.
Get action. Do things. Be sane. Don't fritter away your time. Create, act, take a place wherever you are, and be somebody. Get action.
And it's every photograph, practically, that you can see his fist is in a clench. And one of our historians, Patricia O'Toole, pointed that out and sort of said wryly that if he had been today, somebody would have diagnosed Ritalin and he'd become an accountant. Nothing against accountants, but I don't think we would have had the rough rider that he was. And let's remember that day where he so celebrated his crowded hour, he called it, was an example of reckless leadership. I mean, he was proud of the fact that his regiment suffered the most casualties that day, and the army was aghast. He was disappointed he didn't have a disfiguring wound. What kind of romantic notion of war is this? And he even lobbied to get the Congressional Medal of Honor, something you do not do. And more importantly, and much more seriously, in World War I, too old to fight, he pushed his four sons as close to not just war but combat as possible, with horrible, unspeakable consequences that you'll have to see in our episode three to find out what it is. And I think that the result of that came close to destroying him.
You know, and this is the thing that's so interesting about Theodore Roosevelt, is you get a sense that the way David McCullough puts it, a high-intensity light bulb that burned out quickly.
Yes, exactly right. Whenever I think of that 85-year-old picture, I think of the fact that this is a 60-year-old man who, as McCullough said, is a high-intensity light bulb that burned very, very bright, but obviously expending so much energy had to burn out relatively short.
And you wonder if, frankly, Ken Burns, he wasn't a tad unhinged.
I think he is unstable. I think this is really an important part of him. He's a wonderful human being. If you said to me, hey, I've got the three Roosevelts outside, who do you want to go out to a bar and have a beer
right.
with, or who do you want to drive across the country? I think he'd all pick Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, it's just amazing. But I think, you know, here's the problem. If we go back to this idea of this superficial media culture that thinks it knows everything, you know, we don't tolerate complexity. We throw somebody out. You know, in order to elevate John Adams, we have to toss out Thomas Jefferson. They can coexist.
Yeah.
And more importantly, within human beings, we're suddenly wringing our hands today that we have no heroes. Well, why? Well, we expect our heroes to be perfect. And we're always looking for that gotcha moment. See, you're not perfect. See, you didn't do this. See, you said that. And you didn't really mean that, which is what we all do. And heroism is, in fact, defined by the Greeks, is not perfection, but a very real negotiation, sometimes a war, between a person's obvious strengths and their maybe not so obvious weaknesses. And in these three characters, they have that in spades. And Theodore Roosevelt is sort of the clearest, cleanest example of a deeply flawed human being. So heroism is the negotiation between strengths and weaknesses. So let's try to embrace rather than reject. When you're buried in information, it's hugely important to make distinctions. Ah, you're red state. Oh, you're blue state. Oh, you're rich, you're poor, you're male, you're female, you're gay, you're straight, you're young, you're old, you're east, you're west, you're north, you're south. We always want to put a label so that we're, whew, well, at least I know what that means. But of course, what we've done is condemn something that may have much more complexity to a kind of a prison of our lack of attention. And I think when we open it up and we're willing to look at someone as complex as Theodore Roosevelt and not judge him, John Keats, the poet, said that William Shakespeare had negative capability. You know, the moralist in us want to say, this is good, this is bad. But Shakespeare knew if you held these polarities in tension, you sustained drama. You made it more meaningful. And our English language, our lives are filled with Shakespearean tropes and ideas because he did that. He was willing to tolerate contradictions not only between people but within them. And I think that's the key to understanding not just Theodore, not just Franklin and Eleanor, but everybody. And so this film is trying to say, look, we're not forgetting the big stuff, the Gilded Age, the age of the monopolies and the progressive movement, World War I, the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, the World War II and the Cold War. This is the span of our film. That's the stuff that's going on. But rather than have this argument that we tend to have within our films of is this top down or bottom up, this is inside out. So we want to know the motivations. We want to understand the way in which adversity formed that character, which in turn formed that leadership, that in turn built the world that you and I are living in and speaking in today.
There's one of those sort of stories that has contradictions in it in the episode that people will be watching Monday night. And it's about Theodore Roosevelt, who it may have been one of his first acts, or maybe even his first act as president, he summons a black man, Booker T. Washington, to the White House.
The dinner invitation for Washington was a matter of simple courtesy, he said. The very fact that I felt a moment's qualm on inviting him because of his color made me ashamed of myself and made me send the invitation. A reporter for one of the wire services noticed Washington's name in the register of visitors and filed a story. Although black slaves had built the executive mansion and black servants had waited upon all of its occupants, no black American had ever dined there before. And not only had the president dined with Washington, but he had done so in the company of his wife and teenage daughter, Alice.
White men of the South, how do you like it? White women of the South, how do you like it? The Negro is not the equal of the white man. Mr. Roosevelt might as well try to rub the stars out of the firmament as try to erase that conviction from the hearts of the American people. New Orleans Times Democrat.
The action of President Roosevelt in entertaining that nigger, said Senator Ben Tillman of South Carolina, will necessitate our killing 1,000 niggers in the South before they will learn their place again. The president was astonished at the furor. I would not lose my self-respect by fearing to have a man like Booker T. Washington to dinner, he wrote, if it cost me every political friend I have got. Washington remained Roosevelt's most important African-American ally. But the president never again asked him or any other black person to dine at the White House.
And there's the part of that that seems magnanimous and lovely, but then there's the fact that the country reacts and how he responds to that is also interesting. Would you talk about that story?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that a black man has officially been invited to dinner. It would take the subsequent administration of his distant cousin and his favorite niece to welcome not just single African Americans, but a whole group of people and who would argue on their behalf and legislate on their behalf and struggle to level the playing field, a playing field that clearly is still not level if you read the news from Ferguson or Clive and Bundy or Donald Sterling or Trayvon Martin. So this is an age-old American problem. I've been dealing with it all along. He also, Theodore also has this really terrible, one of the low points of administration when he cashiers an entire regiment of African-American soldiers for crimes they didn't commit because no one soldier would step forward. He punished them all, you know, no pensions, no anything. And a Texas grand jury, please, had already said there was nothing that they had done. It had just been sort of rumors, the way rumors start among African Americans that often lead to lynchings. But in this case, a really terrible blot on a man who's sort of remembered as being Lincolnian in his relationships with race. But it tells you how complicated the political calculus is, that he wasn't willing to risk inviting somebody like Booker T. Washington back again, and he wasn't willing to even mention the Brownsville, Texas incident with these colored troops in his autobiography.
When we're talking about the country's greatest president, you've sort of declared yourself a Lincoln man.
Yeah.
But it sounds as though there are moments when you wonder if, in fact, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, if he doesn't qualify.
I would say, I mean, this is besides George Washington, because we don't exist without George Washington.
Right.
He is at the top of this pantheon. But if you're arguing for second place or who sort of in an operational way is the greatest president, you know, it's definitely Lincoln. Now, the question to me is, and I'd been aware sort of that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the next greatest president. What happened in the course of the 7 years of working on this series is that he rose up to near parity, if not parity, with Abraham Lincoln. Hmm. And that's a testament. I mean, Lincoln dealt with the single greatest crisis in American history, and that was our Civil War. Franklin Delano Roosevelt dealt with the two greatest crises since the Civil War, and that would be the Great Depression and the world's greatest cataclysm, World War II. And, you know, he did it so magnificently. And like Lincoln, like Theodore, like his own wife Eleanor, filled with lots of faults. He's devious and opaque and hard to understand. But my goodness, I mean, to think that he's doing this all from a wheelchair, unable to rise without help, is just one of the great triumphs of the human spirit, I think, in our mythology, and not just mythology, in our real history.
What do you make of George Will's impression, stated really early in the film, that Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt didn't much care for the Constitution? I think George Will says they saw it on some level as a nuisance, at least if it stood in their way.
Between them, Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt would occupy the White House for 19 of the first 45 years of the 20th century. Years during which much of the modern world and the modern state was created.
Jefferson's view of government was that government can only do that which is explicitly enumerated in the Constitution of the United States. Theodore Roosevelt, coming one century later, precisely one century later, says no. Government can do anything that is not specifically prohibited in the Constitution. And he believed that the government of the United States had to be much more central, energetic, and assertive than the Constitution had envisioned it, or we could not go on as a nation.
I think both presidents regarded the Constitution as a nuisance. That is something that was all right in the late 18th century, but just didn't fit their country, and more important, them. They had bigger dreams, and they thought that the Constitution was elastic enough to accommodate their ambitions.
They belonged to different parties. They overcame different obstacles. They had different temperaments and styles of leadership. But it was the similarities and not the differences between the two that meant the most to history.
Yeah, I think, what these two Roosevelts, indeed almost any moment in our history, they raise the central questions of who we are. You know, what is the role of government? And I think it's perfectly reasonable to, if you're going to say that I wish to be psychologically or socially or interpersonally inclusive, to understand that these, all of these things that the Roosevelts did are not without their opposites. And I think George Will represents extraordinarily well the sort of uh-oh side of this.
Right.
That, yes, they see that they've got the idea of how things should be, and they fundamentally change the role of the president. I mean, there are some who feel that the branches should be sort of equally kind of dull and drab and in check. And we inherited first from Lincoln, and then things went quiet for a long time, and then Theodore Roosevelt, and it went quiet after that, and then Franklin Roosevelt, and it's never really gone quiet. The imperial presidency, and he, as he says, this idea that, you know, complex issues will lead to, you know, will yield to charisma of these people, and that of course sets the country up, as I'm paraphrasing Will again, for perpetual disappointment. It's really important to understand for those people who advocate a much more active federal government that it comes not only with its own possibilities of failure and its own negative aspects, but it comes with a huge portion of the population that doesn't think this is the way to go.
Right.
And it's really important to represent that, because this is the fault line which we're talking about today. American history is a constant repair job. The Roosevelts are trying to repair what they think is the inattention of the federal government to the lives of people, that it permitted itself to unfairly be an active agent of only the wealthy. And oh my goodness, here we are again. Isn't that today's conversation?
But look at the litany of the GI Bill, the infrastructure, Social Security, the Panama Canal, a living wage, child labor laws, monopolies being busted or controlled anyway, the interstate highway. I mean, the litany is extraordinary, and it's not an argument, the film, for a strong federal government. But it seems like the Roosevelts' lives seem to make that kind of an argument in some way.
They do indeed. And many things in our history suggest that that was exactly the right thing to do, to survive a depression or to be able to prosecute the Second World War. I mean, on September 2nd, 1945, when the Japanese surrendered, more than 50% of all the manufacturing in the world took place in the United States of America. That doesn't come from small government. That comes from a government that's saying, no, 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 not 5,000 planes this year, 50,000 planes. No, 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 I'm not taking no for an answer. You will do this. I will deliver you big profits, but you will do this. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt did. Remember, just a few years earlier, those industrialists were calling him, you know, the worst sort of things, this dictator and a communist and a socialist. And he called them malefactors of great wealth, you know, and he welcomed their hatred. Well, all of a sudden, he needed to break bread with them to prosecute this war. He did, they did, and the war was won. You know, a combination of Russian sacrifice, American manufacturing, and heroic struggles on the part of our military people. That's the Second World War in a nutshell, and it's really important to understand it in those sorts of contexts. So yes, the world we're in is very much informed by the Roosevelts, and we also understand that when you do these things that seem right, none of us want our kids working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day in a coal mine. All of us love the fact that there are national parks. We plan on cashing our Social Security check, but we also know that what comes with it are military-industrial complexes and bloated bureaucracies and the types of things that the ideologues among us think that you throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I think that the lesson of investigating the Roosevelts is understanding the fault lines and the tensions that we have perpetually since the very beginning of our republic had to deal with, and rather not respond to them with sort of bromides and these superficial conventional wisdom suggestions. Oh, always less government. You know, well, you know, that's really great unless, of course, the Dust Bowl's happening in your backyard and you may not survive unless you've got the government helping you, pay you to not plant a crop or to cull your cattle or to give you surplus foodstuff so that your family can survive. Or, you know, when that unregulated business has polluted your backyard and your kid's hair is falling out, you might want an entity bigger than the marketplace to come in and get involved. But in the abstract, it sounds really good to us. Well, yeah, less government then means also less taxation, which also means I don't give away as much. And so, you know, we are dealing with the three Roosevelts with everything that we're dealing with right now. And that's really helpful, no matter what side of the political argument you're on. And even if you're not on any side and you're scratching your head and say, I can't make, you know, hide nor hair of this. I need, where's the guidance? They'll help you.
Ken Burns, his documentary, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, began last night on PBS stations around the country. It runs through Saturday. Here in Utah, you can see it on KUED Channel 7, beginning at 7 p.m. You can also stream the episodes after they air. Last night's episode is Episode 1, of course. It's available online now. You can go to our website for the link, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Ken Burns. His documentary series, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, began last night on PBS stations around the country. We haven't said much about Eleanor Roosevelt, and it's, of course, a crucial part of the film, so we can sort of leave it to listeners and viewers to know that that's where you sort of come around to, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt in the end. I mean, which makes sense chronologically, but I get a sense, Ken Burns, that you have sort of a soft spot also to Eleanor, that it made sense to come around to her in the end as well.
Well, you know, part of the reason is she's the survivor, but she's huge in every single episode. Maybe not in episode one. She's born there, but certainly from episode two on, she's a major player. We have an extended, probably the biggest chapter of episode two is a flashback about her childhood. She is a testament to the human spirit for having survived. Episode three, you know, she's coming into her own in really important ways as a wife, as a mother, as a betrayed wife, as someone passionately devoted to causes, moving out of the household and into engaging society in the 20s. She's desperately trying to help her husband struggle with the ravages of polio. She is the most extraordinary first lady ever in episode 5, 6, and 7. And then after her husband dies early on in episode 7, we thought we might have to make a beeline for our ending credits. But she just takes over the film and takes it at her own pace. And
she becomes America's mother is also sort of where we come
very,
from
very much so. Yeah. And there's a wonderful scene where Admiral Halsey is bitching and moaning and complaining that he's going to receive the First Lady, who he thinks is just a mindless do-gooder, on an inspection tour of the Southwest battle sites. And she comes and he says, let me tell you what Eleanor Roosevelt did in a day. And he lists it. And it's very, very impressive. And you already know that she is Theodore Roosevelt's favorite niece and has to keep active all the time. And then he says, but when she visited that hospital, you must understand this is a burn ward and it smells horribly. And she just didn't walk through. She stopped and talked to every single soldier, got their name, wrote to their parents, told them how they were doing. And he just marveled. He is completely, you know, she rearranged all his molecules. And that's what she did all her life. We made a film in the national parks and we had the good fortune of interviewing the late Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall. And he said that of Teddy Roosevelt, that he had distance in his eyes. I think all of the Roosevelts had distance in their eyes, meaning they could see beyond the curve of the earth, could see into the future. And Eleanor had that more than anyone else. She understood all of the coming issues of labor, of children, of women, of the environment, of health, of poverty, of race. And she acted as the conscience of her husband's administration. He was a much more practical politician, had to be, because he had a control of Congress, but he had, you know, Southern white committee chairman, and he had progressives from the Midwest and inner city immigrants and African Americans, and all looking for the big tent that the Democratic Party has been for a while. And you know, she was pushing him and goading him, and she's just magnificent. I like to say she's right on absolutely everything except prohibition, you know, and you give her a pass because her father was a hopeless alcoholic.
That's right.
And
right.
Her brother died in her arms in the throes of delirium tremens, and when she was orphaned, she was sent with pious relatives and an abusive nurse, but also two alcoholic uncles. This is all, you know, stuff she saw firsthand. So I'll give her a pass on prohibition. That was a big mistake. But everything else, you know, you can't fault her. It's stuff that's happened. And it drove people crazy. They hated Eleanor Roosevelt, many people. But she saw, and fearlessly, this terrified little girl, fearlessly every single day moved to the thing that scared her the most. And that's, you know, I'm a father of four daughters. I like having someone like Eleanor Roosevelt in my field of vision so that I can point her out to my kids. And I can't imagine there's a woman, and why do we need to segregate this by sex? I can't imagine there's any human being that can't in some way find in her example something worthwhile. In my family, my second daughter, Lily, was terrified of the vacuum cleaner. I mean, she had to be out of the house, asleep or someplace, in order to run that vacuum cleaner. And one day when she was 2 years old, she walked into the room when the beast was howling and walked over and sat down on it. And in our family, sitting on the vacuum cleaner is shorthand for moving towards the thing that scares you. And Eleanor Roosevelt did that every day of her life.
I have to say, I think for me anyway, that was the essential theme of the film. Because Doris Kearns Goodwin says toward the end of the film, you know, great leaders do have to come through adversity, but it wasn't just adversity. It seems like it was more essential than that. It was fear. It was actual fear.
Well, we go back to the original existential fact that is so terrifying. And which is ultimately the source of all fear, which is we're not getting out of this alive. And human beings have built cities and made great art and written extraordinary symphonies and guided themselves towards great faiths. And we've also made war on each other and have argued over the pettiest of things and been mean-spirited and greedy. All of these things happen. And I think what the Roosevelts do is remind us of that essential existential angst, but how you can transform that into something positive. We go back again to that essential thing. We all do well when we all do well. The implication is that we're bound to each other through community, through family, through love, through patriotism, through just inhabiting the same planet, that we know that whenever things get out of kilter, it's not good for everybody. The rich don't do well when there's no middle class, when they're only poor. That may last for a while, but it can't sustain itself. And what each of these three did is work hard to try to make sure that this government, its agencies, its institutions, and its morals were guided by a principle that can be loosely defined as kind of Christian charity. These are all three Christians. You know, Franklin was once asked what his philosophy was, and he said, "I'm a Christian and a Democrat," and that's it. And he was armed, as George Will says, with the Christian faith that the universe is well ordered and with the American faith that history is a rising road. And I think what the Roosevelts all felt was that. And they all – you can all see them, you know, however gimpy FDR is with his braces and his crutches and maybe somebody holding his arm just a few paces ahead on that rising road and said, "Hey, come along. Come with me."
Let me ask you finally, and forgive this as being a kind of quick diversion, but I have to ask because you did a film with your daughter and your son-in-law, David, Sarah and David, on the Central Park Five. And, of course, the news has come out that New York City's finally approved a settlement.
Finally.
$41 million in the case of the five young men that you profile, of course, in that extraordinary film, who are wrongfully convicted of beating and raping the so-called Central Park jogger. This was back in 1989. I have to say, how do you react to that? It must be a very different experience to see a film have a kind of direct, very discernible impact.
Yeah. I mean, the big argument the first day of film school was whether films actually got people to do anything. Mm. And I'd argued rather naively back in that first day in 1971 that it did. And everybody poo-pooed me with this sort of thing. No, no, no. It just preaches to the choir. It activates the people who already agree. But, you know, our National Park film got, you know, 15 million fannies off the couches and into national parks. They had been declining in attendance, and suddenly they had this great spike. And my very first film in the Brooklyn Bridge, the New York Times ran an article when the bridge turned 100 about a couple from Idaho that was visiting there because they'd seen some documentary on public television. So I am convinced that film can actually do something and move things. But someone, a dear friend of mine, pointed out, it's really nice to get a film that has good reviews, and the last few days has been the tsunami, I'm happy to say, of good reviews about the Roosevelts and good audiences and awards and prizes. But there's nothing like doing something that actually helps to change lives. And our film, my beautiful daughter Sarah, who initiated this and who's outrage at this situation, whose sense of fairness, which every single American, regardless of political persuasion, feels ultimately shares a sense that things in the world should be fair for everybody or equal for everybody. She just went at this. And her husband, David McMahon, who's a great filmmaker who I've had the privilege of working with for 15 years, and I just sort of went along and made this film. And it's now been helpful in getting these guys a settlement and putting a period at this long run-on sentence of injustice. And I can't begin to tell you how proud it makes me feel of my daughter, and it makes me feel good. I know these five men. They are now men in their 40s, and they are good men. They were good kids. They hadn't done this. The DNA exonerated them, but only after they'd served out their full sentence, and then they had to spend another dozen years in a limbo because people who make mistakes, particularly people in power who make mistakes, don't often like to admit it, and they still haven't admitted it. They've just realized with a new mayor, as he said, that an injustice needed to be righted. And I don't really care, I guess, in the end, whether the folks who perpetrated this on these kids go to jail or not. I'm just happy that they've been able to escape, as Theodore Franklin and Eleanor did, the specific gravity of this extraordinary adversity, and now, in some ways, at age 40, get to begin their lives.
It's Ken Burns. His documentary, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, began last night on PBS stations around the country. It runs through Saturday. You can see it here in Utah on KUED Channel 7, beginning at 7 p.m. You can also stream the episodes after they air. Last night's episode 1 is available online. You can go to our website for the link, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.